Okay. We're still missing a few. Let's hope they'll pop in. Cold, so my voice is not perfect, but I think Dr. Shem will manage. Okay, one second. Oh my. I see already Woodmere has arrived. Good. Today is the 25th of November 2019. And once again, I say hello to my students in front of me and to those around the big Jewish world. Today is a different world than yesterday. Today we're in the world of the history of Torah. It must be the 7th, 8th year already in the United States. And we've been dealing with the emergence of the modern rabbi or the westernized rabbi, or the Orthodox rabbi capable of meeting the demands of the American scene. We dealt with the big machloket in Cleveland, the 1920s, Solomon Goldman versus Abraham Katz, and ultimately there was no stopping the emergence of the conservative movement. You could win in court that the synagogue is an Orthodox trust, but the minute the Balabatim voted, we're out. We don't want Torah, we don't want Orthodox, we don't want to be stifled. And they go down the block and open a conservative temple. And I picked up a case study which is just amazing, Jacksonville Jewish Center, Jacksonville, Florida. And here we see how an Orthodox shul, with every safeguard and precaution, established in the 1890s, and slowly but surely, it moves conservative. The rabbi we meet in the 1920s is the same rabbi who was thrown out of Cleveland because he opposed McSeeding. Cyrus Adler, the head of JTS, stood behind him, totally acid. A gentleman from Beit Shemesh, I have to ask you something after class. It's a name I need. You may be able to help me. Totally acid mixed seating. And 10 years later, both Cyrus Adler and Rabbi Benjamin Samuel are in this conservative temple, very happily leading them to more change, more innovation. And it's the story of America. Ultimately, we left off last week, and I told you, B'didi Haviyuvda, I've had a very rich life. But at the time I was a kid, I didn't appreciate I'm having a chat with Simon Greenberg. When I look back, 1961 until today, how many years later is it? 60 years later. And it's amazing. He is the vice chancellor of the seminary, davening in my shul, visiting his son. And he says to me, I quote, that with all that we're matter driving to shul on Shabbos, our tragedy is the shuls are empty. And here we see in this thesis on Jacksonville Jewish Center that with all that we're matter driving to shul on Shabbos, they barely have more than a minion if there's not a special event. And imagine they're trying very hard that they should attract 75 people on Shabbos morning. So you see, time moves on. Let me go further. The High Holy Day service. Time moves on. Tell me, how did you daven Rosh Hashanah? What was the story in the old country? What was the story in East New York, Lower East Side? You began davening 8:30, 9 o'clock. The davening went till 3, 3:30 in the afternoon. Here in this conservative temple now, the Balabhatam are very unhappy with the length of the Rosh Hashanah service, which ended close to 3 p.m. Changes were made in the service that on Rosh Hashanah it should not end later than 1 p.m. So here too, you see, all right, I don't know if we can criticize this. I know where I daven, we do finish. We started 8:45, I think they started this year. If I'm not mistaken, they started at 8:45, and we finished 1:05, 1:10, went right into Mincha. So, all right, but you can see, the people are complaining. We're no longer daveners. It's not the old country. Shabbos morning, the junior congregation, and if the parents don't drive the kids to shul, the kids will not show. Most of the parents don't go to temple on Shabbos. So now, by the 1930s, they vote unanimously that the synagogue buses will make the rounds on Shabbos and pick up all the kids. So you see, one by one by one, even they're coming up the ladder, mainstream conservative, very proud, nothing holding them back, no more machlokets. The Orthodox element has their downstairs minion. Ultimately, the Orthodox element pulls out and organizes Eitz Chaim congregation, where a graduate of this kola later becomes rabbi, and now the Balabhatam are free to do whatever they want. In the 1950s, that's when Rabbi Sanders A. Tofield has come in. He's come in the 40s. He becomes an international figure. He's a member of the Committee on Jewish Law, which is the Halachic Committee for the Conservative Movement, a little bit different than the RCA. In RCA, it's called the Halachic Commission, and there you have a decision. There's only one answer given to any question, but when it comes to the Conservative Movement, you can have a minority decision, a minority decision, a majority decision. There are 23 members of the Beit Din, and you can have as long as three rabbis have a say, it is considered legitimate. And this is exactly, Rabbi Tofeld now becomes very well known because he's the one that wrote Shivat permitting women to get aliyot. He dealt with the whole question of Shabbos observance and how he shows there's a development that at times we were more machmir and now as time moves on we can be more lenient and we have to deal with the realities of life. And the shul as a conservative temple thrives under him. And you can go on and on and on. All that happened to this Orthodox congregation by the time you hit the 40s, you don't recognize any trace of Orthodoxy. It is conservative with a capital C. And that's a classic example. Well, this begs a simple question. Where are they today? This thesis, and it's a lot more than just the pages I'm holding in front of me. This thesis traces the history through 1960. What do we mean by 1960? That's the year that Rabbi Kalfield dies, and once he dies, it's like an era has ended. Where are they today? 2020. Here, you go to their website. Jacksonville Jewish Center. Proud to be hosting world-renowned bluegrass band Nefesh Mountain as special artist in residence at the center the Shabbat and weekend of November 22nd, 24th. Join us for a special concert on Saturday, November 23rd. Now, I hope the special concert is Saturday night, but they boast here, join us for a unique Shabbos experience with Nefesh Mountain. We begin the evening with our Shabbat in the round service with the artist in residence joining us. followed by a reservation-only barbecue dinner. Seats are limited for dinner. Make your reservations now. All right, if we can go to the Jacksonville Jewish Center, I'm very much a friend. What does it mean, a barbecue dinner? How do you make a barbecue dinner on Shabbos? Except I'm hoping maybe the chicken, the steaks were barbecued before Shabbos. We'll give them the benefit of the doubt. What does it mean that the visiting band, and there's here, they're advertised, you see, what does it mean they're participating in the service? They're davening, or they're leading it with musical instruments? I hate to think, but I'm probably thinking correctly, that they're using musical instruments on Shabbos. If a temple already can use an organ, and you can use a mixed choir, and all that goes with it, here you have a visiting band. Who knows how Jewish they are? But, all right, they can participate. This is the Saturday services. But that's a small part of it. First visit. Welcome to the Jacksonville Jewish Center. And here they are trying to attract people. Josh, they interview someone named Josh. Quote, "Not so long ago I would not have believed I'd be active in a synagogue. A number of years back, Lauren and I both realized that we wanted to explore spirituality. The Saturday we visited, Rabbi Lublina gave a sermon in which he said it was totally acceptable to be uncertain about God. And when I heard that sermon, I felt welcomed to the congregation." So you see here, you've come 120 years after the shul began, listen to the rabbi's sermon. Uncertain about God. What does this remind you of? Mordechai Kaplan. Judaism as a civilization, whether there's a deity or not, is very inconsequential to the Jewish experience. Civilization. But this is not all. You can be Malamed Tzchut. Maybe the rabbi is trying to tell him, Tamu Ru'u. You understand, I always tell people who hack me ahead how difficult Yiddishkeit is, which, you know, they look at it from a distance. Shabbat and Kashrut and Tarat Mishpacha. And I tell them it's the easiest thing in the world to be a good Jew. Tamu Ru'u. Taste it and see. So, all right, the rabbi preached the sermon. This is much more serious. About us. Welcome to the Jacksonville Jewish Center. Thank you for your interest in our synagogue. The center prides itself on being a warm and caring kehilat kesha. And we welcome everyone, all inclusive, married, partnered, and intermarried, interpartnered families seeking a home within the Jewish community. You realize what you're reading here? Intermarried, interpartnered, Jew married to a Gentile, Jew living with a Gentile, no family, no kedushin, no yichis, no tarat mishpacha. Welcome to the club. And this today, if you know the conservative movement, this is one of the issues that is being widely debated. Obviously, the lenient side will win out. That's constantly the way it works. Nothing left. Water it down. Make everyone feel at home. Marilyn Monroe walks in with Arthur Miller. All right, at least she had a reform conversion. They'll be happy to take Marilyn Monroe even without a conversion at all. Partners, no marriage. What's going on today? In our world, people refuse to use the word Ba'ali, my husband. Are you aware of it or not? In modern Hebrew, if you want to be up with the crowd, Ishi. You use the word Isha, Ish, Ishi. My mate, my male half, whatever you want to translate it. But take a look what you're seeing here. Intimate. couples, married, not married, Jew, Gentile, everyone welcome. Then you look at the rabbinic staff. Meet our clergy. Rabbi Yonatan Jonathan Lublina. All right, I have to tell you right away, he looks more like a rabbi than I do. Take a look. Absolutely. Then the other rabbi, Rabbi Shira Rosenblum. All right? Not commenting on her looks, just mentioning to you she's the other rabbi. The Chazan, Jesse Holza. I wonder which Holza family he is part of. It's certainly not Manny Holza's family. And you read their biographies. And here, Rabbi Lublina, I believe he's born and raised Westchester County, New York. Earned his bachelor's degree with honors from Vassar College. M.A. from JTS. Later ordained. Served in congregations Connecticut and New Jersey before becoming the senior rabbi of the Jacksonville Jewish Center in the summer of 2004. And here it describes his activities. First of all, you see from his background, how many years did he hold by learning? The guy never, did he ever go to yeshiva? Did he ever learn a Daf Gemara? Graduate of Vassar College, 1985. In general, at the seminary, today there's nothing to talk about, but even 30, 40 years ago, where I had friends who taught at the seminary, they compared their students coming in like a seventh grade kid in the day school. You follow? In an American day school, the seventh grade kid, he's barely starting to learn Gemara. So these are people coming in at the age of 21, 22, they barely can handle the rudiments of the most elementary aspects of the Gemara. One time I had a student, the Kolo, a dear student, his picture is right here in the cup, you have to understand what this is about. I can give you the story briefly. He comes from a very famous Lakewood family. And many brothers and sisters, father, terrific, terrific Rav, Talmud Chacham, and went into Jewish history, autodidactic. And this kid had the misfortune, he was here in Mir after high school, and he had the misfortune of hearing a guy named Rakefet speak at the OU Center. It's a true story. And he made up his mind, he's going to study with this guy, Rakefet. So he calls YU, and they say to him, you can't get into Gris Kollel. You need a bachelor's degree to begin with. So I don't know how he worked it out with the correspondence, with the computer. Within a year, he has a bachelor's degree, and he goes to Gris for 1 year in New York, and he comes into the Kollel, and we remain very close until today. When he finishes Gris and gets Smicha, he goes to Mir. So I go to visit him. He wants me to see Mir, gives me the whole tour, and they take this picture, the entrance to Yeshivat Mir, and what you see in here is a Mishnah in Makot. Talmud Shagala, Maglin Rabo Imo. What Talmud who goes into Gullis, went to Mir after YU, they send his Rebbe to Mir. So, he's working in outreach. He's getting a doctorate today I've been after him for years to get a doctorate because I told him, Balabatim, swallow rabbis. But if you have the title doctor, somehow they don't bite so hard. You understand? It's not like Richie. He's a real doctor. When I got my doctorate, so my daughter was so excited. My eldest daughter, she's a little girl, was 66. So I explained to her, I'm not a doctor who can heal. I'm a doctor of books. There's a big difference. But nevertheless, Balabatim doctor, all right? So he's involved in outreach. And we were much younger. And now people call me if they can come over Shabbos. We're never home. We go to our children's Shabbos. Our daughter lives within an easy walk of our house, my eldest daughter. But I remember Leib says, can I bring someone I've met? She's studying to be a rabbi at Hebrew Union College. I said, oh, great, bring her. And he comes with her, and I start asking her, what are you studying? What does Talmud mean? Oh yeah, we have Talmud. And she explains to me. They take a Gemara, like the Gemara in Menachat, the Tzagado with Rabbi Akiva, where he's learning and Moshe Rabbeinu comes in. You remember the Gemara? And Moshe Rabbeinu is overwhelmed how much he knows. And Moshe Rabbeinu is like, why didn't you give the Torah through him? Who am I? And suddenly he has to quote Moshe Rabbeinu, Halacha l'Moshe miSinai, and Moshe Rabbeinu felt better. So they take that Gemara and they analyze it for a month, she says. So every three times a week, they talk about the Gemara, who Rabbi Akiva was, what the Gemara means, what it means generations. I couldn't believe my ears, and that's what they call Gemara. So you see, you're dealing here as though Rabbi Lublin is ein gesund, but it's far from someone who is a Talmud Chacham with that type of background. At one time, the seminary took all the Reitz graduates, 50% of Reitz. Are you aware of it? 50% of Reitz wound up the seminary in the 30s, the 40s, into the 50s. In my time already, it was quieting down. The Rav had become a personality, and Chaim Potok was the last famous person to leave YU, and you all know why. He was frightened by the Rav's temper and Rav Yochum Gerel. Are you aware of that, though? His novels are autobiographical to a certain degree, and the Shoffman is the portrayal of the Rav. And he has another guy running around there that represents Rabbi Ruchim Jurelik. And yeah, they were pretty rough guys. I admit it myself. You had to be able to handle, as Yitzchak and I spoke last week, I think it was after class, about the Rav in his prime. You had to be able to handle their greatness, and they were to shoot from the hip. Rabbi Ruchim Jurelik was infamous for it. We managed. Chaim Potok was frightened. He went to the seminary. But this is Rabbi Lublina. Then they talk about what are his activities. They're very proud of him. He's a communal rabbi. He's a personality. He's involved in interfaith dialogue. And they tell you what his position is in the community and the committees that he belongs to and what he accomplishes. And yes, you see a wonderful rabbi, but it's all involved in Tikkun Olam. And Tikkun Olam, nothing to do with the Jewish people, the general community. That's Rabbi Lublina. Rabbi Shearer Rosenblum, here I have to say this is a first. I never dreamt about this in 1,000 years. A 2010 cum laude graduate of Brandeis University, active in Hillel, later goes to the JTS where she graduates, and tremendous ability as a teacher of preparing young people for bat mitzvah, bar mitzvah, and she's an early childhood counselor, but above all, this lady rates number 2 in Massachusetts in archery. She can shoot a bow and arrow. Could you imagine on here with the bows and arrows on Lag BaOmer, she could defeat anyone. Having won 11 medals and attaining a statewide competitive ranking of number 2 in Massachusetts, Rabbi Rosenblum has been selected to represent Maccabi USA in this summer's, the 20th World Maccabiah Games in Tel Aviv. She is the sole member of its inaugural archery team. It's the first time that you have Jews who are great in archery and can compete from the United States at the Maccabiah. So this gives you a good feeling of what really happened and what happens throughout America. This is USA anywhere. For us as observant Jews, it's a sad story. But this is the reality. And ultimately, the Orthodox element has to break away, goes down the block, Eitz Chaim. It's a thriving community until today, but in Eitz Chaim, I would imagine 90% of the people are Shomrei Torah and Mitzvot. It's like the young Israels. ultimately, the old type of American Jew who came to an Orthodox synagogue, his children and grandchildren, they don't have that commitment anymore. They don't have that feeling. They're not from, they go to a temple, if they go at all. And this is Jacksonville. One additional comment in honor of current events. You all know that the Shluchim Conference is taking place. 6,000 Shluchim gathered in New York. Yomo questioned me earlier today, where is there a place big enough? I just got an email with a link to the Shluchim Conference. And Yomo asked me, what place is big enough? You know where they hold the conference. It's a former armory for World War I to train soldiers. I don't know if you recall. I recall very well. They built armories where soldiers marched and shot and did exercise, training them to go overseas. These armories today are outdated. So in Brooklyn, I don't know how many armories, but this one was converted into a hall, and you can taka keda for 6,000 people in this armory. And that's where it's being held. Anyone here from Brooklyn, Richard, do you have any idea how far it is from 770, exactly where the armory is? But cover to Chabad. Chabad has developed, how many shluchim did you say are in America? Do you remember the number? 1,700?
1,780.
How many?
1,980 in America.
1,980 shluchei Chabad in the United States. And they have succeeded in piercing the Jewish community. In other words, people who never dreamt going into a Reform temple, a conservative temple, so distant. And Chabad has picked up so many people. I don't say they're successful with all of them, far from it. But they create Jewish feeling, Jewish identity, and you can never tell when they spark a kid to come back and find his roots. And it's very inspiring. They are unique. You have to give them credit. Even Satmar today and Lakewood today, it's not the animosity against Chabad that once was. They say that in Chabad, they just built in Brooklyn, I actually saw it, a whole little condominium, apartments for shluchim when they come in for the conference or other reasons to come to New York. Beautiful apartments, food available, unbelievable what's accomplished. It seems that some Satmar money went into it. And they asked, there's some Satmar people who are billionaires. They asked, how do you come to help Chabad? And they answered, when we travel all over the world, Chabad honors us, courts us, helps us, is available for us. We want to pay back. And this is Chabad. So when you talk about the escape, yes, it's true, Reform, conservative, but there is Chabad, and the role they play is admirable. Part of their secret is they don't charge. You can come into Davin, they don't charge. You don't have to buy a seat. You're welcomed. You'll ask yourself, how does the Shaluach raise his budget? Well, I think it's the first 2 years, if I'm not mistaken, you can correct me, I think it's more than a year, I think it's the first 2 years, they're subsidized from New York. After that, you're out on your own. And how do they raise the budget? It's very simple. In every community, you have the masses and you have some very wealthy individuals. Ultimately, you can appeal to the wealthy individuals, help us keep this house of worship going. And you can pick up, and that's the story that now, again, I was overjoyed yesterday, Morty, you heard the tape, the lecture, I was overjoyed yesterday that everything I told you about the Rav, here's Rabbi Lichtenstein certifying word by word the source I showed you. I'm overjoyed. My mind is right. I'm honest. If Rabbi and I are saying the same thing, I doubt if anyone's going to question Rabbi when he talks about the Rav. So I have to tell you, I've entertained you over the years with the stories of my relationship with Morris Engelberg, right? Omar Singelberg is? Wow, make believe you do so the union passed for the wise. Joe DiMaggio died in his arms. You understand? Morris Engelberg, he was DiMaggio's publicist, lawyer, accountant, advisor. Joe only trusted Jews. You can, his whole life. And Morris Engelberg, when I went to visit him, so I told him, more if you, God, Morris, what happened to you? A graduate of Toras Chaim in Brooklyn, Azal Sheikitz and Neuswaf. I told him off like a good Litvak. That's the first time I met him. We come back 2 years ago and meet him again. We're both the same age, except he towers over me. He was a sportsman, and I couldn't believe it. All he wants to talk about is the shul he built and the Friday night dinner once a month. Everything I've told you in class with all the halachic problems. He doesn't know the halachic problems, I know. But who brought him back? His wife, his daughter, Chabad, picked him up. Unbelievable. No, Jack said, ah, Rebbe, you're making it up. Chabad finally fell on it. Go to the websites. Big articles. What does Joe DiMaggio have to do with Chabad? And in the new Chabad shul, in I think it's West Hollywood, it's called, the hall, the Simcha Hall, is called the Joe DiMaggio Hall. Could you imagine a kid gets bar mitzvah there and they give him a picture of Jolten Joe DiMaggio? If the rabbi only knew, pick up a shear of rakefet and give it to the kid. Eulogy for Joe DiMaggio. Yitzchak Adkan. Alright, that is Jacksonville Jewish Center today. And I'm happy I was able to, and it's a real thing with Chabad. It's all over the world. You can be cynical. I told you yesterday the story with the tefillin and rakefet. All right, I'm a lamdin, and this kid, at least I try to be a lamdin, and this kid is a Baal Tshuva. What does he know? But he's putting tefillin on. You can be cynical, but you got to give credit. They have developed a certain type of Yiddishkeit that is loyal to halacha, and you can pick up a totally irreligious person with no connection. No, I mentioned Chabad in honor of the Shluchim conference, and because we saw what happened to Jacksonville, I don't want you to say everything is lost. I'm positive there is a shluch of Chabad in Jacksonville. No, not assuming. I'm positive. There's the Eitz Chaim, there's the Conservative Temple, and there has to be Chabad with all the shluchim across the United States. My dear students, the final source, how RCA is born, and this source vindicates everything I've said for the last year already. And this is a fabulous volume. I've quoted it before. Jack, can you give me the name of the volume?
New York's Jewish Jews.
You didn't believe it yesterday. I said New York's Jewish Jews, and Jack said, what kind of title? The Orthodox Community in the Interwar Years. If I were writing, I would use Interbellum Years. It's a fancier word, but it's interbelligerent, Interbellum Years.
That's Weissman
Joslet. Yeah, this is Jenna Weissman Joslet. And as I hinted, I felt she is within, this lady grew up within the Torah world because she writes with such insight. And we finally had contact from people listening. She Tata grew up, I think she went to High Line, remember, Flatbush. This lady knows what's going on. Now, here.
It's a year of the book?
1990. The book is 30 years old. I reviewed it for Jewish Action. I didn't republish it because when I chose whatever I republished now in Rakafadar and Chelik Dalid, I chose what's Kitvuni Ladart, what I felt has 1,000 years from now it'll be important. But all right, a book review, except my work on Meir Kahana. There I have two book reviews. But with Meir, I suffer because it hurts me to see how the world only sees one side of Meir. And you heard me yesterday how I differed with Meir. But it's a mitzvah to talk about the total picture, the black and the white. Okay, but leave that for another time. Her last name is Joselit. That's evidently her married name, Weissman Joselit. Okay. Now, you see, what JTS accomplished, by 1902, JTS was falling apart. When I visited JTS in 1902, there were window panes that were broken. There was no money to fix them. Effie, you're wondering how I visited JTS in 1902. It's very simple. The memoir literature brings everything to life. So JTS would have closed down. The truth is, it had no place. Stewart, right? It had no place because the immigrants looked at it. Das heißt der Rav, was, et gelernt, dem genommen ein ganzes Jahr, zu machen ein Siem in Meseches Megillah. Das heißt der Rav, that's a rabbi. I know that too, from editorials in the Talgenblatt. You follow me? But there were a few Jews who said, we need an enlightened orthodoxy. And they put in money, and Jacob Schiff is the prime example, president of Temple Emanuel, who had been raised on the lap of Rav Shinshofol Hirsch in Frankfurt, billionaire, and he put in money, and they brought over Solomon Schechter. Time doesn't stand still. I have a student in the Sunday class, he was my student in BMT the second year, 1970-71. He's now a regular on Sunday. Evidently, he can work it out with his work. Time doesn't stand still. I look at him, it seems only like yesterday. But before you know it, he's a grandfather. I'm a great-grandfather. Many times over, Baruch Hashem. Within 10, 20 years, there's a new generation, and they don't want a European rabbi. They still have respect for a European rabbi. But the rabbi they want on a Saturday morning, someone who's Americanized, can speak English, give a sermon that they can identify with. Mordechai Kaplan, early JTS graduate, Orthodox, not Orthodox, conservative, Reconstructionist, Mordechai Kaplan, when you go through his diaries that we've spoken about, and she quotes the diaries extensively, quote, this is Kaplan speaking, Kaplan observed that, quote, a graduate of the yeshiva that acquires that way of speaking can easily pass as a conservative rabbi. And what did he mean? What did he mean by that? Knew how to speak English. His English was correct. There was no accent. Mordechai Kaplan here is giving credit to Rietz, or bemoaning the fact that Rietz is now turning out graduates that look, act, preach like a fine conservative rabbi, and yet they're totally orthodox. Herbert S. Goldstein, in his autobiography, or what's written by his grandson, I should say, but it's based upon a written autobiography that Herbert S. Goldstein wrote, Rabbi Goldstein, his grandson, Aaron Reichel, put it together as a book. We've quoted that many times. The Maverick Rabbi. So he tells the story. He was in law school. And he says to himself, do the Jews need another lawyer? No, they need a modern rabbi who can keep them within the Torah world. And he decided to become an English-speaking rabbi. Graduates JTS, which was semi-orthodox at the time, and gets smicha privately from Rebbe Chanan Jaffe, And here's the way they described him. Rabbi Goldstein symbolized the new type, the American type of Orthodox rabbi, cutting a dapper figure in his frock coat and top hat, and eager to display a large, if not always correctly employed vocabulary. Goldstein attempted first at Kehilat Jeshurun, and later at his own institutional synagogue in Harlem, to make Orthodoxy appealing to young native-born Americans. See? The new rabbi, the American rabbi, the modern rabbi, the westernized rabbi. And I remember studying, remember, Yitzhak and I had the schut, we studied with all three, rabbis Goldstein, Lichtenstein, and Young. And I remember Rabbi Goldstein saying, occasionally use a word that your balabatim won't understand. Let them look it up in the unabridged dictionary. Show them who the master is. I don't know if that's correct or not, but that was Rabbi Goldstein. And he had a sharp, almost uncanny ability to understand the needs of American-born Jewish youth, second generation American Jews, and he was tremendously successful. And they would ask him, well, if you're so successful, how do you look at the great Rabbanim, the European Rabbanim in New York? Among them were Lamdanim of Hakim, even at that time. Among them were Poskim of Hakim, even in the 1910s, the 1920s, and he would say, the European rabbis are, quote, physical storehouses of Jewish law. I defer to them on halakhic issues. I fully recognize that in regard to questions of halakha, of Jewish law, we must look to our older rabbis. But these men could not handle the second and third generation. To occupy the pulpits, we need genuinely Jewish and genuinely American rabbis. Orthodox Jews will have little hope of survival unless this is the new type of rabbi we can produce in the United States. This was Herbert Goldstein. More than that, he was a sports fan. In his clubs, remember we spoke about all his clubs? He brought in Benny Leonard, the most famous Jewish athlete at the time. No one heard of him today. Time moves on. It's 100 years ago. I grew up, I knew who Benny Leonard was, the boxer. He was two different type of world champions in two different featherweight boxing, welterweight boxing. Imagine what this meant to the kids. Benny Leonard comes into the institutional synagogue. And he had that uncanny ability. One time, this is quoted in all, anyone who writes about Rabbi Goldstein, kids were walking out towards before Adon Olam. And he says, young men, would you walk out of a baseball game before the last out was made? Please, don't treat the synagogue any less than the Poligrounds. He was a big Giant fan. Poligrounds were within walking distance of the Upper West Side. I still remember the Poligrounds like yesterday. And it's amazing, no one gives credit to them. At one time, four of the starting nine team were Jews. Four out of nine. And the Yankees never, until the 70s, they never really had a Jewish star. And I always thought it was anti-Semitism. Stephen, no, the Yankees were not stupid. Money speaks, Rakefet walks, right? You know that. The Yankees desperately wanted a Jewish star. They would bring in the Bronx alone, there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Jews. So they went after Hank Greenberg, my father's neighbor. And Hank Greenberg, a Yiddish cup, he was at Columbia, a student. He comes to the ballpark and he sees Lou Gehrig at first playing. And he says to himself, I'll never get a chance. he's a fixture at first base. And that's how Hank Greenberg wound up with the Detroit Tigers. Of course, you never know how life works out. I need not tell you Pride of the Yankees, the story of Lou Gehrig and the Lou Gehrig disease. He gave it the name Lower Langno. But you see, this was Herbert Goldstein. He understood what the American rabbit was about. Derech Eretz, yes. He's not going to argue with a Litvish Rav, a European Rav. Derech Eretz, yes. He knew his limitations. Not all of us, I remember when the Chayim was issued, the Issa was issued in 1956 against Mixed Board of Rabbis, Synagogue Council. So I remember some of the more left YU graduates were saying, we're also rabbis, we also have a right to an opinion. And I remember I was in the Beis Medrash when I was a kid, but I didn't accept that so easily. They're rabbis and they're rabbis. We all have a right to an opinion, perhaps in our congregation. But when you have a major issue, and here you have Reb Moshe Feinstein, and you have Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, and Reb Yitzchak Huttner, and the Telzer Rosh Yeshiva, and Reb Aaron Cutler, and you can go on and on with the list of 11, including two YU people, Reb David Lifshitz, Reb Mendel Zaks, I don't know if we have a right to say we're also rabbis. At the best, we can say, well, Moreinu v'Rabbeinu Rav Soloveitchik did not sign the Issa, did not sign the Cherem. So all right, we have a right, but then we have to stand the Rav. The Rav's position was not so easy to understand. It was pagin and dibura, if you understand what I'm saying. He was very fine about it. He finessed his position very simply that on general matters, that which unites us is much more than that which divides us. But on halachic matters, he demanded that the Torah people have a veto. And that's the way synagogue council went. They had a klal that on all halachic matters, any rabbinic body, Reform, Orthodox, Conservative, belong to them, can have a veto. What that meant in real language was that you're giving the Orthodox a right to have a veto. But very, very fascinating. Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein's viewpoint, yes, I'm an American rabbi, I can preach, I can speak English, I can reach out to the new generation, I can talk baseball, but he recognizes when he has a shaila, he has to go to the European Rabbanim in New York. They are filled with knowledge which I don't have. Now, another great individual, younger than Herbert S. Goldstein, of course, was the famous Joseph H. Lookstein. As we all called him, Little Joe, he was maybe 5'5", if that much. But what an individual. It's a blessing. I got to know all these people quite close. Joe Lookstein, I got to know better than anyone, because in my work in Revel, I interviewed him after all my archival work, which was very smart. You don't interview people before you do archival work. You do it afterwards, because the archives don't lie, but individuals see it through their own prism. And here I'm quoting Lookstein. He observed of his career in the rabbinate that I was a symbol of what American Judaism could achieve. An Orthodox rabbi trained in a traditional yeshiva and at the same time commanding the language and culture of the modern day and comprehending the spirit and mood of America. And quote Rabbi Lookstein again, and then he had a play with words, I wanted to be a modern version of the rabbi of old. A modern version of the rabbi of old. And here you see Rabbi Joe Lookstein, it's a different type of rabbinate, a different type of lifestyle. She analyzes it very fascinatingly. How do you act in a shul? What's the rabbi's position? How does the rabbi dress? And Joe Lookstein, this is in also a memoir that he left. He tells the story when he first was appointed assistant rabbi of Kehilat Jeshurun. So he was living in Brooklyn. Pitkin Avenue was the big shopping center. You can ask, I can only tell you my wife will certify this, although she left Brooklyn at the age of 9 months. But she remembers her mother and grandmother talking about Pitkin Avenue. And it seems on Pitkin Avenue, he bought some type of modern coat. I don't know what type of coats we wear today, how we would call it, but it was the latest style. Comes into shul with this coat, and the balabatim are aghast. And he says one of the balabatim called him aside. It would later become his father-in-law, and I think the name was Schlang. And he tells him, Rabbi, this coat does not befit you. You have to wear a more rabbinic type coat. And he taka listened to his father-in-law to be, and he gets a nice black overcoat, and he walks in again, and some of the ladies say to him, Rabbi, you're the best dressed rabbi we have ever seen. But you see, there's interaction here. It's no longer the rabbinate of yesteryear. Much more to it. What about the pastoral duties of the rabbinate? You are in the rabbinate, you have to visit the sick. You have to perform marriages. You have to meet with the couple before you marry them. You have to deal with bar mitzvah boys. Later on, you have to deal with bar mitzvahs. You have to deal with controversy between the men's club, the sisterhood. The rabbi gets involved in endless activities where you see today what happened to Yeshiva University. If you're studying for the rabbinate in NYU today, you have many different auxiliary supplementary courses dealing with pastoral matters, psychological matters. There's one course I saw on the website. Rich Shever brought it over from America, where I couldn't believe my eyes. NYU pays money to bring in professional actors to act out a machlokes, a fight. And the rabbis have to discuss how would they would solve it, how would they deal with it. And all right, Ellie, let me be honest with you. Maybe if I had had such courses, I wouldn't be sitting here today. I'm sitting here today because I got my head chopped off in 1961, 62. I was all of 23 years of age. Yitzchak, if you had these courses, maybe you and I would have been infinitely more successful in the rabbinate. But you see, it's beginning already. Rabbis Goldstein and Lukstein and Young, what were they required to do? What was the Yudapayisha Rav required to do? What was Reb Chaim Brisker required to do? Reb Chaim Brisker didn't even speak on Shabbos HaGadol and Shabbos Tshuva. The Rav told the story many times. I believe I write it up in my first volume on the Rav, that he once gave up to give a Tshuva drasha. And he broke down and cried and said, who am I to give Musa to people? I should give Musa to myself. And he never preached the drasha again. You're the Pei Shira. What did the Pei have to do? I'd get up Zitzin and learn. And he didn't even Paskin Shilas. He brought in the Brisket Dayan, right? From Simcha Zelig Riga, when you came to him with a Shila. I told the story, I believe it's in the Washington, in the Rav too. You said, what's going on with you? It's in the Rav too. That when Reb Chaim, they came to Reb Chaim with a Shila, what did he say? Kenish. Gave some Brisket, gave some Brisket Dayan. I don't know how to answer. And then Reb Shit tried the same thing. And Reb Chaim said to him, my son, listen to me. When you say I don't know how to paskin, they'll believe you. When I say I don't know how to paskin, no one believes me. But you see the differences developing here, what you expect out of a Rav. And this again is Joe Lukstein. What are we talking about? American rabbis, their usefulness is determined in our day by the ability to conduct an interesting and decorous service. And he was famous. KJ, they say after Shabbos, he would walk through the building, check if the Siddurim would put back, check if the banners were polished. He would tell the custodian for next week, all these banners here, people walk holding on, have the banners, is the right word? Am I using the right word? What word am I looking for?
Banister,
you say?
Banisters,
I don't know. Okay, we'll check it out on a bridge. All the banisters have to be polished. The metal, the shul had to be beautiful, attractive, not a shtibel. And the high point of the service was Lichtenstein's sermon. A celebrated master of the language, with a keen ear for the evocative phrase, the verbally skilled rabbi used his scrupulously timed 40-minute address to good advantage. And Rabbi Lichtenstein would say, the sermon has to be as contemporary as the morning Saturday newspaper. Those days, everyone read a newspaper and had a newspaper delivered. I'm not already talking to Halachic Shaila. Are you allowed to have a New York Times delivered Saturday morning? It's Muktzer, it's Nola. It's an interesting Shaila. It didn't exist before. Maybe the paper did, the print didn't. Is the print something tangible? Interesting Shaila. But he hit the nail on the head. The sermon has to be as interesting as the morning paper. The length of the sermon, and here he tells the story that when he first came to start preaching in English, he preached for 20 minutes. He felt more than that would bore the congregation. We spoke about that a few weeks ago. He said, Balabatim called him over, Rabbi, the sermon is not long enough. It takes at least 30 minutes to develop an idea properly. But what does that show you? That the Balabatim were coming to shul not just to daven. The davening was the minor part of their experience. They were coming to shul to hear the rabbi speak, to hear the rabbi preach. But there's more to that, and this takes us to another area of the rabbinate. Tell me, how many of you lived in Europe in the 1800s? FEI lived in Kovner in the 1800s. Tell me who the chief rabbi of Kovner is, Reb Zohanan Spector. What do you think? You walked into his house, he invited you Friday night. Reb Zohanan was busy around the clock, paskening shilas from all over the world, writing tshuvot. Right or wrong, there was a certain deference. Tell me, is this da chassid? Is there anyone sitting here? Gera chassid? When did you see the Gera Rebbe? When you went to a tish, there were 5,000 people there. That was it. In the American rabbinate, the Lichtensteins introduced the concept of home hospitality. Together with his wife Gertrude, who I knew so well, little Joe and Gertrude had Balabatim over Friday night, Shabbos lunch, Motzai Shabbos, Amalava Malka. He introduced the term for it, at homes. It's the rabbi meeting the key congregants at homes. He transferred the Orthodox rabbi from an aloof, distant, if revered personality into a socially accessible one. A fallible, witty, and in Rabbi Lichtenstein's words, a chevreman. And wow, you can see this is a new type of rabbi. It's not a new type of orthodoxy. People say these rabbis created modern orthodoxy. I would rather say they created a modern rabbi capable of meeting the American scene. The greatest among them, the most famous among them, was Rabbi Dr. Leo Young. And Rabbi Dr. Leo Young, first of all, he already was on a different level of scholarship. He was European trained. He had grown up in Europe. His English was practically unaccented. There was a very slight Germanic, I would say, accent, but it was very inspiring to hear Rabbi Lichtenstein speak. And his English was fluent, was native. He spent so many years in England, but he was European. You see, Rabbi Goldstein was born on the East Side. Rabbi Lichtenstein came to America a youngster, I think 8 or 9. I told you a number of weeks ago the exact year. Rabbi Young came to America, he already was in his early 20s, there was a connection to Europe. And he already saw what had developed in Europe. You have to remember, in Europe, there was a westernized orthodoxy that already by the 1920s, the 1930s, was a good 60, 70 years old. Rav Simsterothel Hirsch, what developed in Germany, begins in Frankfurt, Berlin. It's a total rebirth, but it was called Neo-Orthodoxy. What does the word Neo mean? Neo, new, a new type. It was very different than the old type of Torah in Frankfurt and in Berlin. There were Gedolei Yisrael there. Rabbi Hirsch turned it around to an orthodoxy that could reach out and speak to the masses, put it into the language of Germany of the 1800s, the 1900s. What went on in London? London had a tremendous success in having a dignified United Synagogue. Rabbi Young's father was part of it. Rabbi Young saw it with his own two eyes, so that Rabbi Young already, there was great influence what he had seen in his youth. Now, one of the things that Rabbi Young did, which neither Lichtenstein or Goldstein did, and here you have to give Rabbi Young all the credit in the world, and this is what Rabbi Rubin referred to a number of months ago, he recognized that what made Rabbi Hirsch so well known and so successful, that he kept on publishing. You could pick up the printed word, Rabbi Hirsch's commentary on the Chumash, his commentary on the Siddur, his commentary on Mishle. I believe there's a commentary on Tehillim as well. The Pirkei Avot commentary was later published unto itself. His drushes for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur Yeshurin. Rabbi Hirsch made material available. Rabbi Young, give him all the credit. Essentials of Judaism, his first volume. The Jewish Library, ongoing volumes, one after another, right through, I believe the last volume was published well into the 1980s. And he made a world of material available. And when we were growing up, if you wanted to read anything about Yiddishkeit, about Torah, about how it conquered the world, you had to go to Rabbi Young's books. There was nothing else available. And I, in particular, owe him a big thank you, because in his set of Jewish Library, he got involved in biographies of Gedolei Yisrael. And there, you can pick up, if you're interested in Torah history, his biographies were fabulous. He edited them. They were written by many different people. But there you met Rav Shmuel Hirsch. There you met Rav Yitzchok Chanan Spector. There you met there was one biography of the man. There you read Sama Shnira. There you met the great Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael. He was across the board in these volumes. There you met the Ritbaz. Wonderful. I don't say they were top scholarly volumes, and a lot has been written subsequently, but the initial work, it's Rabbi Young who made it all available. Tarat Mishpacha, more than anyone else, he spoke and preached and published about Tarat Mishpacha, built beautiful, modern, updated mikvaot. And again, the other part of Rabbi Young that Rabbi Lichtenstein and Rabbi Goldstein didn't have, because of his European training, he was all over the world. He was the one, and he had the Balabatim to support him. He was the one supporting every type of Torah activity from Palestine to Eastern Europe to Germany, wherever there was a need, be it Poli Agudat Yisrael, be it Agudat Yisrael later, be it the Mizrahi, whether it was Beis Yaakov, Rabbi Young was there. And more than anyone, he put a dynamic, modern orthodoxy on the mat. And I'm quoting Rabbi Young now. He tells the story of a Jew who flatly accused them of being a hypocrite. Quote, "You look, speak, and act like a gentleman. Your education must have been deep and wide. Your knowledge of general subjects, you couldn't possibly be orthodox." And that's Rabbi Young. That captures it. One of his admirers wrote, "Rabbi Young was among the foremost who helped with the transportation from the Lower East Side to the Upper West Side and dressed Yiddishkeit with aristocratic clothes." End quote. And Stuart, I have to tell you here, this is exactly what I heard from Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik. The Rav, one of his public drushes, he spoke about Yiddishkeit as an old lady. They have been describing his mother, his machatenister, the Tolna Rebbetzin, an old lady, old-fashioned clothes. And he said, the challenge to us is not to change the old lady, but to dress her in more sophisticated modern clothes. That's the way we have to take the Torah. No changes. The old Torah from all the generations, and dress it and garb it in the clothes of modernity. That's what I heard from the Rav. And this is exactly what Rabbi Young is saying. And dress Yiddishkeit with aristocratic clothes. And this is a beautiful thought. This is the challenge. You can take it much further. The State of Israel, we've come a long way. 120 years ago, there was absolutely no Yiddishkeit here beyond a few ghettos. The Yiddishkeit you had was from the old home. And it took great idealists. It begins with Rav Kook, Rav Moshe Tzvi Neria. They built the Yiddishkeit. That's Israeli. That's part of the mainstream here today. It's a different ballpark today. And this also explains to you the Haredim who were so afraid to come out of the ghetto, and you can't blame them. They saw what happened to all of us that came out of the ghetto, talking about the Ashkenazic Jew, how many fell away. And today, Baruch Hashem, they have much more confidence. But part of the confidence is not just within their own camp and success. It's because they see their Jews walking around all over with kippot, with beards, with payas. Turn on the Israeli TV, see the news, see who some of the reporters look like, and the women with their head covered or with shekels, etc. And it's a process at work. But part of that process is that we're dressing Torah in the aristocratic garments of the State of Israel reborn. With all its challenges, Baruch Hashem, we're here. We have the challenges. We have to meet them. But that's exactly Rabbi Young's quote. Now, something else about Rabbi Young, where he was different than Rabbi Goldstein and Rabbi Lichtenstein. Intellectually, as we said, he was a much greater scholar. And in his sermons, there was always a little bit deeper thought. In other words, a good rabbi, when he speaks, everyone will gain something. So the masses, on their level, will understand the rabbi, you know, superficially, but they have a message. Someone who sees between the lines sees that this man is alluding to concepts way beyond the simplistic message. Can anyone tell me who became his greatest devotee? Picked him up in Jewish Center, listening to his sermons, writes about it. Hermann Wouk, who just died. Hermann Wouk. And this is Hermann Wouk, would later write of his first encounter with Rabbi Young. And then the ideas surprised me. Religious ideas, articulated in the light of secular wisdom I had learned, and some secular wisdom that I hadn't learned. In one respect, however, the rabbi departed from what was rapidly becoming a rabbinic norm. He publicly encouraged ritual observance, particularly family purity laws. And here you have to understand, it's not easy for a rabbi to talk in public about family purity laws. You're dealing here with Sneat. Today, I remember Machon Gold in the early 70s, mid-70s, I would give lectures on Tarat Mishpacha. Later, I saw, Baruch Hashem, there are women who are more learned than we are. Tarat Mishpacha can give these lectures, a woman to a woman. It's much more, much better than a man speaking to women. But here you talk about Rabbi Goldstein and Rabbi Lookstein, but it was Rabbi Young more than anyone that pushed Tarat Mishpacha in public. And you want the proof to it? Who here grew up in New York? On the Upper West Side, you always had a major, beautiful, well-kept, upkept mikveh. On the Upper East Side, there was basically never a real mikveh until modern times. You had mikvot and shtiblach, but the women all went to the Upper West Side, crossed Central Park to go to mikveh. It was Rabbi Young. It was his influence. Now, and here she's absolutely correct. This rabbi, it's all being developed. There's a interaction, Balabatama interacting. It's every shul has some conflict. The old God, the young God, the old God looks upon these new rabbis suspecting they're not really orthodox. The young God is absolutely in favor of the English-speaking rabbi. But as time marches on, the young rabbis take over. The opposition dissipates. Balabatam have an opinion. Balabatam have a say. But what makes them very, very different from the conservative world is that these Balabatam, here I'm quoting Max Setra, that Max Setra says, there are certain decisions in Jewish life which cannot be determined by majority vote of the Board of Trustees or the membership of the congregation, quote unquote. This is Max Setra. And this is the other part that fits into the puzzle. You can have American rabbis, English rabbis, rabbis who know baseball, rabbis who can meet the needs of the congregation, but you have to have Balabatim who are willing to surrender to the Vahashem Zu Halacha. That's what will keep them orthodox. And Max Setra, who becomes a very famous individual, we've spoken about him many, many times, he is a classic example of a Balabas who is as opinionated as he was. I knew Max Setra. We're actually related. I think I told you his part of the family is very wealthy, and there are other members of the family, and they never acknowledged the relationship to the poor Rothkopfs. Ah, but when my brother, I don't talk about myself, but my brother became a medical doctor, conquered the world, a bright young man, suddenly family popped up. And I knew Max Setra. He was opinionated and strong-willed. But kala kavod, if the rabbi ruled on something, he would never question the rabbi. The only time he questioned Rabbi Lookstein, remember I told you? When Rabbi Lookstein wanted to bring the women downstairs, remember? I mean, it's classic. Classic. That's when he goes along with the rabbi, then he comes in the next day. Rabbi Lookstein, if you bring the women downstairs, even though you'll have a mechitza, I'm leaving the shul. Rabbi Lookstein says, why? He says, I went home and told my mother. She said, I will not daven in a shul like that. Shul dafzayin, the balcony has to be two flights of stairs up like it is in KJ. But you have here the rabbi, you have here the balabatim. We have arrived. The stage is now set. It's obvious. The Europäische Rav and the American modern rabbi, their language is not the same. Worse than that. And I take you back, I think I spoke about this maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Worse than that. The Europäische Rav was not willing to accept the American rabbi. You know, the Europäische Rav, let's face it, I'll take myself as an example. I wasted 4 years in high school. I didn't play games. I graduated valedictorian. I wasted 4 years in college. I didn't play games. I graduated number one in a class of, I think, 86, I think it was. I didn't, summa cum laude, I didn't play games. I got 2 masters, a doctorate, it took time. No. At the age of, let's say, 25, Europäische Rav would look at me, an Oisvat, an Amoritz. When I was 25, I knew this, I knew that, I knew the other thing. What the heck do you know? And I asked you, how many Daf Gemara did you learn? Yitzchak, you got Smicha in 1962, am I right?
Three.
How many Daf Gemara did you learn by 1963? Give me a figure. 100, 200, 300. Gentlemen, it's true. How much knowledge did I have? Shulchan Aruch, come on. A few simanim in Yoredeya. What did I know? But you see, the Europäische Rabbanim made one bad mistake. Look at me today. I learned the rest of my life. I balanced it out with everything. I was able to sit and learn and be machadesh. And I'm not ashamed to talk with anyone in learning. Come on. I'm going through the Aruch HaShulchan now in Chayshim Mishpat, which only certifies when I sat in Dinei Torah, Rabbi Teitz would say, do you want the halacha? Or is it a pshara? If you want the halacha, we will give it to you black and white. But I'm warning you, you may not like it. It will scare you. It will be difficult. Or do you want to make a compromise which will make us, you know, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, I'm quoting that sign. So they would always say a compromise. You go through Chayshim Mishpat, that's the secret of Chayshim Mishpat. Look at the Aruch HaShulchan, time here. Einei ra'ot ha-beitin. Einei ra'ot ha-beitin. So, alright. So, but what am I saying? The Elter Rabbanim had the Agudas Rabbanim. The Agudas Rabbanim was a live organization. It was alive and kicking and had influence and power. And then Reitz is starting to graduate rabbis. And Rabbi Revel is pleading with them, take in my graduates. And this is in the 1910s already, certainly by the 1920s. And their attitude is, no, these are not Rabbanim. These are not Europäische Rabbanim. These are second-rate rabbis. We're an organization based upon the Lithuanian Rav, the Polish Rav, the Rabbanim we know from the old country. We can't take in these youngsters. What do they know? And this ultimately was a very bad mistake, because as time marched on, the Europäische rabbis disappeared. The younger element was not there. It was not just the Reitz element. Reitz was everything at the time we're talking about. Later you have Teira Vadas, Chaim Berlin, Rabbinic Alliance. It's not Agudas HaRabbanim. Agudas HaRabbanim, Rabbi Shulva pleaded, take in, his son was a Reitz graduate, take in, no, the Elter Rabbanim, they had this attitude, which perhaps they were right. At the age of 25, I couldn't learn like a Europäische Rav who never went to high school, never went to college, never went to graduate school. But at the age of 85, I'm willing to take on, I'm not there yet, but we'll be there very soon. Time flies. At the age of 85, I'm willing to take on any Europäische Rav. They missed the boat there to a certain degree. I don't say every Reitz or Teira Vadas or Chaim Berlin graduate became a big Talmud Chacham, but they had the ability. if they would apply themselves. Gentlemen, in 1935, the shoe dropped, and you have the organization of Rabbinical Council of America, Histadrut HaRabbanim. How did this come about? Let me end off the class with this. Ellie, how did it come about? All right, let me explain myself, Effie. What did we say? The Agudas Rabbanim was constantly having machloket. You all know what happened with RJJ. Yitzhak Stern, what's your first name?
Yitzhak.
And last name?
Shlomo.
Shmua. Shlomo. Shmua. You've been here before, years ago. From the Tversky dynasty. Your Rebbeim. No, you're not there. I remember years ago we were speaking. Okay, say them, we'll work it out. But what was happening with the Agudas HaRabbanim? Gentlemen, you need bread and water. Without bread and water, you can't get off the floor. We all have to make a living. The Rabbanim came to America. How are they going to make a living? Shuls did not pay a salary. In Europe, there was no such thing as a shul paying a salary. The rav is paid by the city. It was a shtut rav, city rav. The rav came to Boston, so you all know a number of shuls brought him over. He made his living not by a salary, by giving shayurim, by funerals, but above all, Rabbanim made a living from kashrut. Kashrut, you have to pay people to supervise. When you get involved in kashrut on an individual basis, the machlokes is endless. And the chance, the booby trap, the attraction to be lenient, to sell yourself, it's all over the place. That was my introduction to the American rabbinate, the call I got in 1961, and without going into any details so you can't identify, Rav Rotkov, we have a hechsher for you. Take over a bakery. I look into it, Mechalel Shabbos, etc. So I called the Rav, and the Rav told me, you can't give hechsher. Maybe you can separate the meat and the milk and the parav and tell people they can buy there under those. It was Philadelphia, there was no kosher bakery. But to give a hechsher, Mechalel Shabbos. And the Rav says to me, Vasily, when I turn it down and I say, why can't you do it? He told me he has to go into the Shlachtites. I want people to say, give Hechsher tomorrow. So, if you can't, how can I? Vasily, Rabbi Rotkov, du willst sein Reich? What's with you, Rabbi Rotkov? You don't want to be rich? Money. The machlokes was endless. Now, people from Europe were used to this. People who came to America, the 1880s, the 1890s, they grew used to it very quickly in the United States. But an American has a sense of integrity. It's part of the at least then. I don't know what goes on in America today. But at least then, it was part of the American heritage. And I remember the Yerupeisha Yeshiva, this I heard when I was a kid, the Yerupeisha Rosh Yeshiva used to say, an America bachas anders, an American kid is different. He has a sense of honesty that you didn't find in a European kid. There's a greater sense of honesty, a greater sense of integrity. There are probably reasons why. It's the old Europeisha shtick. In order to survive, you had to play games. In America, like the communists. I've told you many times what went on in Russia, and then these Jews come to Israel, they have to straighten out, or we wind up having an Avigdor slash, what's his Russian name, Lieberman, you know, schizophrenic, etc. But American kids, now the Balabatim, the rabbis, they couldn't tolerate this. And the OU deserves the grace, the greatest credit in the world, that Herbert S. Goldstein gives up a private hechsher on sunshine crackers and gives it over to the OU. And he never took money. All right, he didn't need money. It was Harry Fischel's son-in-law. But he gave it over to the OU. Now you have one product, two products, three products. The people are clamoring, We want kosher food, reputable. You have the OU. You need rabbis. And that's exactly how the Rabbinical Council of America begins. It is basically a subsidiary of the OU. More than that, REITs, the graduates went out into the world. You all know that in unity there is strength. And people, we're in the same profession. You come together, you talk, you feel good, you're happy, you learn. People present papers. Chaim Richard is in a type of medicine dealing with birth problems around getting pregnant. You attend a conference, right? You pick up information. You feel better. You meet colleagues. So it's inevitable that as REITs turns out, rabbis after rabbis after rabbis, 10 a year, 15 a year, 20 a year, they want to form an organization. They go to Rabbanim, won't let them in. So you see, it's called today YU Rabbinic Alumni. Then it was called the REITs of Yeshiva Alumni. It didn't have a fancy title. But they already were organized. They joined with the OU rabbis. They formed the RCA. And this is one of the great, great achievements on the American scene. 1935. Rabbinical Council of America. A direct result of what today we call YURA, YU Rabbinic Alumni, and the rabbinic body of the Union of Orthodox Congregations. Technically speaking, the OU administers the monetary aspects of the Hechsherim, and RCA provides the rabbis. That's the way it began. Today, the OU is so big that really has become a source of income. It's not for the RCA rabbis. It's for Babich, Satmar, wherever you go, Rabbanim are all over the world, and this gives them panasa. And it's dignified. It's not the Balabatim who you're giving the Hechsher to paying you, it's the OU. And it's worked out with supervision and supervision of the supervisors, their field directors, field people. They visit, they check on what the local rabbi is doing. They give you guidance. You have no idea what the OU is today. It's all computerized. Every type of ingredient in the world is in the OU computer. Where it's made, how it's made, what the shilas are, how you transport it. You gotta realize, Effie, transporting, you can take all the kosher things in the world, you put them into barrels that are not kosher. Tremendous barrels go on ships. And not only the OU, the OK, the Chafk, Eder Haredit, Chief Rabbi Nit, Kashrut, they all work with this computer system which was engendered by the OU. And you see, and all this could only come about because a modern rabbi was created. And when you look back, the Rav was right. The big three. There were others, Rabbi Drachman, no question. The big three, Rabbis Goldstein, Young, and Lichtenstein. The big three. And finally, I caution you again, this is not modern orthodoxy. Modern orthodoxy develops afterwards. There already you see, not Rabbi Goldstein and Rabbi Young, but certainly Ramaz and Rabbi Lichtenstein. He already is in a more modern orthodox configuration. Modern orthodoxy, you don't have to go any further. Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Rachman. There, right there. You don't have to go any further. But that's yet to come. That's not yet. So first of all, Ani Modeh LaKadosh Baruch Hu. I have no idea. I don't realize how old I am, and I'm not smart enough. smack my face. I have to know what my limits are. And Friday was a very hard day for me. I had a family simcha. I couldn't take a nap. And then I got that terrible news of the death of the Chama Lamb. Dedicated the Shias that I spoke about her yesterday. It hurts. The Ribbono Shel Olam runs the world, but sometimes we have to yell and shout. And I had a bad cold last night, and I prayed to the Ribbono Shel Olam, let me be able to teach today, and I Modeh LaKadosh Baruch Hu. I also thank the wonderful students who came. I apologize to your son-in-law. I get very angry when you walk in and hear me tell jokes on Jewish history. Had you been here yesterday, I would have been happier. Got me? You shouldn't think that the Rav only turned out Jewish history jokers in the 50s. That was a sideshow. All right, so Zayn Gesund, Richie. Richie, it's a pleasure to see you. How many years ago were you in my class? Give us the year. Which year? Give me the year you were there.
73.
So you were in Rehov Arbabanel. You were yet in the original building. All right. So to reiterate, before I get to the freebies, what did we do today? We finished out the creation of the modern rabbi. Not modern orthodoxy. We'll get there. The modern rabbi. I love Weissman Jeslik's chapter. You follow me, Dov? That chapter with the quotes. I love Rabbi Young. You're a hypocrite. You speak English so well. You have so much secular knowledge. How can you be orthodox? You're a hypocrite. All right. It's mind-boggling. And Herman Wouk, he probably is Rabbi Young's top protege. You have to give credit, because he would have walked away. The fact that his grandfather was a Rav in the Bronx, you know how many Rabbanim there were in the Bronx? Do a survey, if 5% of their descendants today are from, we're doing great. So we did that. We finished out Jacksonville, and we visited the synagogue today. You saw what I read to you. Imagine intermarried couples, not intermarried, but living together. Everyone is welcome. The band that visits for Shabbos. Again, it doesn't say they're playing their musical instruments, but if they're sitting in the round, you can imagine what went on there that Shabbat. And their second rabbi in command, the lady, what a great lady. The top Jew alive in archery. And I tell you, when I saw that, I said, wow, bring her here on Lag BaOmer. We pick up again Sunday at 9:05 a.m. Be'ezrat Natan Layov Koach. I only asked the Eibush, I've been running from house of mourning to house of mourning, that the Halavai give us a respite, but the Segeit Mishtazeis, Kohelet wins out. This is a magnificent article on the 6,000 shluchim of Chabad, the world's most misunderstood photo. And what the article shows, when you look at the photo, Mark Abel looks at the photo, and you go, yeah, they all look alike, right? Each one is so different. You got to read the article, who they are, what they do. Beautiful article. This is a very sad article, but all right, the Ribbono Shel Olam is slowly but surely, every Jew in the world who's still Jewish will have to come in Aliyah, unfortunately, the way they're coming. There's a way to come. Effie is young enough to come, Koma Miyut, but I don't know what's going to be 20 years from now in Woodmere. The old new kind of anti-Semitism in New York City. Hard to believe what's written here, but true. This is an amazing article. Church of England report admits Christian anti-Semitism helped lead to the Holocaust. And this is the Rav. The Rav time and again said that the Catholic Church and the Church in general bears responsibility for the Holocaust because it made anti-Semitism fashionable. And here they admitted there's a whole article on anti-Semitism, etc. This is an amazing article. Chazal tells us, the Medrash tells us that the snakes walk, right? So you hear the Medrash and you say, all right, it's a night Medrash, but how can it be true? Snakes had back legs for 40 million years before losing them. New fossil shows. So I'll ask Morty as a scientist. Charlie is not here. Charlie, best regards if you're listening. Give us your opinion of this article. But I showed it to my wife. She was ecstatic because she said she still remembers in Ramaz when they learned about snakes walking, they all laughed. Yeah, take a look. Any of you who are friends of Rabbi Young, these are pictures of him visiting Chabad when Kfar Chabad was just getting off the ground, and he was helping to support it. Beautiful pictures. And some of the letters that come up from the archives. And here's a letter to Mr. Max Schreiber. I know the family well. I taught his descendants. These were the mikveh people. The Schreiber family built mikvah all over the world. He's in correspondence with them. This is Mr. Norman Lieberman about certain appeals. This is Barry Lieberman's family. Amazing to see the correspondence and what comes up. This is letters to Rabbi Young. This is from Oitzar Paiskim telling him what he's been appointed to. And there are more letters here. Very interesting, the archives today and what the internet does. Ashreinu Shezachinu. Here, these are letters of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe, dealing with Hatzalah. And my Talmid, this is Nachum Shmayel Zazak, is trying to do research. Again, I say he should go to Bernard Revel, get a doctorate, and lesson Chabad. There are people who can teach him how to research and how to write and how to footnote, like what I gave out yesterday from Lakewood. And here, the Rebbe is trying to get food for Pesach and kosher food all year for DPs in the camps. And here he gets Rabbi Suv involved. Here you'll see the answer from the joint to Rabbi Suva, how much money will be needed for the kosher food. Here's an amazing picture of Reb Moshe Feinstein reading a newspaper. It has to be up in the mountains. It looks to me like a Yiddish newspaper, not the New York Times. And there's Reb Moshe. What a beautiful, beautiful picture. Also, he's in the same Matzav Amin today. We both need haircuts. He needs in the picture, and I need in reality. Go and find the time to get a haircut, but we'll have to get there. This is Nikki Haley, whom the Rebbe is putting Kvitlachin to the Kotel, that she should be the president after Trump. And this is about how they're going after her already, that she did like Mrs. Clinton, sending emails through something that was unsecured. This is amazing. Lithuania is issuing a coin in memory of the Vilna Gaon. And on the coin is Hebrew writing. This too is amazing. Yitzchak Mirashalavili, obviously a Georgian Jew who's a billionaire, pledged 1 year ago at the Shluchim Conference he will sponsor 100 new Shluchim across the world. 1 year later, 100 new shluchim are being sponsored by his organization. Here, this is what I told you about. They're badgering Israel. How are they allowing in the Satmar Ruv? He said this, he said that. And Rakefet says, not only allow him in, Eli, encourage him. He just gave out tens of millions of dollars. But the money winds up in the Israeli economy. Willy-nilly, you have no choice. You have to buy bread, you have to buy milk. It winds up in the Israeli economy. Baruch haba to the Satmar Ruv. This is very interesting about a teacher and his advice from the Rebbe. And finally, the ultimate picture. No, who do you recognize there? Who here? Who is it, Effie? Tell the class. That is the Mash from Whitmere and from YU. And it's the Mashpia. I can't say Mashpia. This is my Talmud. You think BMT only turned out medical doctors? We turned out Mashpiam as well. And here he is at the seventh Rebbe's grave, the ultimate picture. My dear students, I thank you very much for your participation. I want to tell everyone, I keep on getting emails people visiting, if they can come into my class, where it is. So let me say it very clearly. Anyone can come into my class. The room has room. We can fit in 25 people here. If you're coming with 100 people, let us know in advance. We'll shift to the auditorium. Anyone is welcome. Shir is Sunday, Monday, 9:05 a.m. I don't want to go into details now. There's a reason why it's 5 minutes late to allow people who hear Rabbi Miller's Musa talk come up to class. Where is Gris located? Right next to Machon Lev. If you take a taxi to get here, taxi drivers still think this is BMT. So you can tell them, if the taxi driver is over 60, tell them BMT. If he's not over 60, tell him HaBinyan Al Yad Machon Lev. If you're coming with Waves, am I pronouncing it right? Waves, how's it pronounced?
Waves.
Waves, W-A-Z-E. If you're coming with Waves, Rechov Baruch Duvdavani, 40.
Waze actually has Gruss code.
Gruss on it. I can tell you, Baruch Duvdavani lived across the street from Maran HaKefet. He lived on Rav Chaim Berlin. He was killed in an accident, Lo Aleinu, a wonderful, wonderful Jew. And I'm proud to say the street is named after him. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vidanya.